Minister of Parliament. We are dealing with this morning, in particular with the wholesale and retail sector and the agriculture sector. Now, just to indicate to the two CETA CEOs that this is a process that we are following with all respective CETAs. We've agreed that it's important for us to get a perspective from the Department of Higher Education and Training, and therefore also in all those engagements we've got a representative of the Director General's office. However, we do know that historically there were at times not so strong alignment between the department where the accountability rested and, in fact, the CETAs, the respective CETAs. And hence we've agreed that apart from us getting the broad strategic presentations from the department, we have to engage all the CETAs individually. And over the last 2 months, we've done just that. You also remember that we sent out a circular sometime early this year with quite a few questions. And that is all to analyze the information that we're getting from the department, the information that we're getting from yourself in these meetings, and what you said earlier. And obviously, juxtaposing all of that. I also want to thank the females of Parliament and in this room. We've celebrated again on the 9th of August, a very, very important day in our lives, which is quite special. One of our members, in fact, have the First Lady of a municipality in Limpopo. I've seen that they were able to, in fact, recognize the work, Ms. Mashwana, the work that you are doing, not only in Parliament, but the work that you are doing in your locality, and continue flying the flag with pride and dignity, as you've done, and also to all the females. Let me then say to the members that after this briefings, we'll obviously deal with the minutes, matters, and we'll also be dealing with that issue of last week that we had to deal with in terms of the legislation, the draft bills. So the CEO of Wholesale and Retail CETA, you've got the floor. You can also just introduce your team.
And thanks for the opportunity to come and present to the Portfolio Committee. My name is Joel Dekhole. I'm the CEO of the Wholesale and Retail CETA. And on my right, I've got the chairperson of the board, Mr. Ivan Molefe, who represents Labour on the board. And behind me, I've got Andy Lespengani, who is a chief officer responsible for qualifications and research. And then Mrs. Daphne Matwa is our chief financial officer, CFO. And next to Daphne, Dr. Henny Swartz is our chief operations officer. And then the last person I'd like to introduce is Mrs. Lana van der Westhuizen, who is our regional manager of the Western Cape office.
members, what I want to suggest, are you winning, young man? Are you winning? Okay, good. Just hang on for a few seconds, otherwise we'll just use the copies that we've got. Thank you, members. Over to Mr. Dehole.
Thank you, Chair. Apologies for the problem with the technology. The presentation we have put together, Chair, is based on your request for us to deal with particular issues. I've already introduced the delegation, and this is the six areas we were asked to present on. So I will take you through the presentation. We understand our mandate, Chair, to be a mandate that is given in the Skills Development Act, so whatever we do has to govern by the prescripts. In November last year, we had a board strategic planning session, and we as management prepared what we believe are action plans for 2010-2011 financial year based on the extension of the CITAS license by the minister for the year ending March 2011. So we basically looked at our service level agreement and looked at the National Skills Development Strategy 2, which is what the Minister of Higher Education and Training indicated we will have to focus on and continue. As you are aware, the 5 year of the NSDS 2 ended in 2010, so we are continuing the 6th year. So we basically looked at each of the indicators and agreed as a CETA what our target is and what is our projected budget. I think you can see on that screen, if you're looking at mandatory grants, we have projected a budget of 230 million. That's what we will pay back to all the organizations that submit their skills plans and the ATR, the annual training reports. Over and above that, Chair, for the past 10 years, we've assisted all small organizations to submit their reports, and therefore we have a project that drives this project. This is still a continuation of the different indicators on learnerships. We've got a big project for 2010-2011. We are showing 2.8 being 2,500. And if you look at the a bottom on 4.1, 650. We have actually been able to get the board to approve this project, and it should be publicized very soon, and the training will commence. And then we have for small non-levy paying organizations, we have a project, we call it Project RAVE 2. This is an old project of the WNR CETA. RAVE standing for Retrenchees and Victory to Entrepreneurs. That was the popular name of this project. We have agreed that we need to bring back that project because it was a very successful project for small and non-levy paying organizations. Under 5.1, Chair, we, as you are aware, the NSDS2 requires us to establish institutes of sectoral excellence. These are basically a collaboration of all the institutions which offer projects which may be of a special nature, or these are scarce and critical skills. We've set aside about $30 million for the project. And then at the bottom, these are just additional targets that all CETAs have to submit. Provincial linkages is an area that requires us to be part of what is happening in provinces, and also make sure that if there are projects that these skills forums come up with, we are able to participate in those programs. This is just over and above what we would do as a CETA in the different provinces. And governance remains an important element of the work of the CETA, and therefore we set aside money for the audits, for the capacitation of the board, and the annual general meetings of the board, of the CETA. Then there is an issue of our collaboration with FETs and HETs. We have been working with FETs for the past 10 years and with some of the universities, but we believe that there is an opportunity to increase that collaboration, and we need to do more projects. Inter-CETA collaboration, we will talk about it, but here we're looking at working with the Agri-CETA to ensure that the farmers do have retail skills so that they can sell their produce. And the other project that I didn't indicate here, we have a project with the clothing and textile CETA where we are collaborating on a qualification that will benefit both sectors. The MDP, Management Development Program, and the Women Development Program, Chair, these are programs that address leadership development in the wholesale and retail sector, and they are normally informed by the stakeholders who come together and inform the CETA on what type of programs we need to work on. This is just an expansion, Chair, of how we see collaboration with the Agri-CETA, with CBOs, NGOs, and co-ops to ensure that we do make an impact in this in rural development. This we will submit, Chair, that we really haven't done much for the past 10 years, but as management and the board, we felt that it's an area that will require our creativity and innovation. The slide says priority three. Chair, if you will recall that when the Minister of Higher Education extended the license of the CETAs, he indicated that there were a number of priorities that government was pursuing. So to that end, we as a CETA looked at what is it that we can contribute towards young people who are not at school, are out of university, but they don't have employment. We believe that we can put through about 5,000 young people through a program to ensure that they have a workplace learning experience, workplace experience. Sorry, because that's an area that they need very badly. And on adult education, for the past 10 years, we've all tried to implement ABET, not to the extent that we would have loved to. And we have now developed a new qualification in our wholesale and retail sector to address adult education through this NQF level one. We believe this program will go a long way to deal with the negative messages about ABET. Chair, you also asked us to do an analysis of our budget for 2009-2010. Our revenue, which mainly comes from skills levy, we had budgeted 412 million. We ended up with 466 million. We exceeded our budget by 55 million. And the reason mainly is because we noted that although the number of levy paying companies decreased during the year, there was an increase on levies primarily because of payroll. And then on the expenditure side, we had budgeted to disburse about 596 million. We ended up disbursing 381 million. So there is a variance of 215 million which we didn't disperse. As a result, that gave us a surplus of a variance of 214 million. And the reason that we have the surplus for the year was 97 million versus a budget of 164 million. That's an unfavorable variance of 261 million. And mainly the reasons for the expenditure being below what we budgeted for is firstly that when we advertise projects, we always set aside quite a lot of money, and often there is a very low uptake of discretionary grants, and we have to basically write back some of the money. And we also have a very high learner dropout rate. At times, it is in the region of about 40 to 50%. And because we don't pay for high learner dropouts, we will ordinarily write back the amount of money into our kitty, and that impacts on our ability to disperse the funds.
Can I ask, in an example of like that, what's the type of interventions by the management to, in a sense, reduce that dropout? What is the systems, what is the processes, what is the strategies, even if it's 30%?
Chair, what we have agreed with the board is that we will make a very informed view of what is causing the high dropout rate. But over the past years, we've learned from our stakeholders, from the companies that take on these young people, that some of them are not ready for the level of the program, and therefore they drop out. Others do find that the stipend, for instance, that we allocate for them to stay on the program is very low, and they tend to move on to other opportunities. So where they are able to find employment or find other opportunities for development, they will move and leave the program. So there are quite a number of reasons why they do that. And what we've agreed we will do is present to our board a recruitment and selection strategy, because we believe that is primarily an area that we need to get under control. We believe that it is important that learners go into the right program and at the right level. For the past 10 years, we basically allowed organizations to do the recruitment, but we believe that the time is ripe for us as an organization to prioritize the recruitment and reduce the high level of dropouts. We've also noted, Chair, that other organizations that are implementing our programs have been very successful because before learners go into a learnership, they have what they call a pre-learnership program where they basically prepare the learners to get into, be ready for the learnership. And we found that where an organization has taken time to prepare the learners, that the results have been very successful. We've had a project, for instance, with Tabombeki Development Trust for Disabled People. It's been one of our most successful projects. Took in 100 learners on a pre-learnership. At the end of the first year, all the learners were ready for the next program. We've just celebrated 50 of their graduates with them. So as management, we are continuously paying attention to why there is a very high dropout rate.
May I just follow up on that question? Could you tell me what your thoughts are and plans are for an organized mentorship scheme? Because it's not, I mean, selection is very important, and it's very important that you have a robust system where you don't set up students to fail and learners to fail. So the selection process has to be very carefully done. But you also have to hold student hands. You need an organized mentorship program as part of a retention strategy. Are you looking at that model?
Yes, Chair, we are actually. That's, I forgot to mention that. That's more than just recruitment. It's also retention. Currently, the way the model works is that organizations will be responsible for, you know, holding the students' hands and ensuring that they are mentored throughout the program. But we also believe as a CETA we need to perhaps even fund mentorship. Perhaps let me give an example. We have what we call new venture creation, which is one of the programs that we have to implement. And what we found that is that when the learners have finished new venture creation, they do not sustain their programs. They do not go into business for various reasons. And one of those, we believe, is mentorship. And we have considered getting people in business, for instance, who have the experience and the expertise to continue supporting these learners in all type of mentorship intervention. So it is something that we've been considering.
So we would be able to know by the end of this financial year the number of learners that you've got here in terms of projection, and also the number of, in a sense, the reduction in dropout. I think that's where we are. I've picked it up both from the department and from various CETAs. We are able to analyze the problem, but it's in terms of making the corrective interventions. And some is more research and some is more analysis, whilst it's actually just practical interventions. So we then will appoint further processes. Whilst it is just the management of that strategy, I think that's really the trick here. But let's park that. I just asked the question and wanted members to problematize that further a little bit. Because what it means is we effectively, the money goes, learners have been recruited, but you've got a 40% plus dropout rate. So it's a channeling that's happening, but there's no real intervention of how do we reduce. We've got a similar problem at the higher education institutions, where there's NSFAS funding going into the process, but you've got a 45% dropout. So the question is, we all know that, where the interventions are supposed to take place, what is those interventions? I think that's really, Member Bukula.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Coupling that with another question of your reasons why you have what you call surplus. I actually don't like that term. The chairman knows. Because surplus is what you get when you've got profit. When you have not dispersed funding, it's not surplus. We have not spent it, that's it. Now, the other reason is low uptake of discretionary grants by stakeholders. What is that and what is the remedial intervention?
Yes, if I can give an example, I think about 2 years ago, we set aside almost 50 million rands for workplace experience grant, where we offered companies a stipend for 6 months, and we said we would expect the companies to also commit 6 months so that we have learners in the program for about 12 months, and hopefully at the end we would expect that these learners are taken by organizations. And the uptake was very low. In fact, we probably had to write off close to 40 million back into our kit. We've also had money set aside for adult basic education and training, and we didn't have the uptake of the many numbers that we were hoping we would do that, primarily because adult basic education has not been well received in the sector, and I think other sectors will attest to it. And therefore, to get around that problem, we went back to the stakeholders and said, how can we repackage APET? And that's how we came up with an NQF level one qualification. We currently now have 1,000 learners who are going through a newly repackaged NQF level one, which is not just looking at fundamentals of maths and literacy, but looking at giving the learners communication skills, computer skills, business skills. So it's but in a different form that is welcomed by organizations. In fact, we are now being asked by more organizations if they could enroll their learners because they see the benefit of the program. So there are quite a number of programs where we, as the city, have set aside money, but the uptake has not been what we've expected. I think, Chair, it's also important to indicate that 99% of the stakeholders in the wholesale and retail sector are actually small retailers, small organizations, which employ between 1 to 50 learners. And that's an area that we believe we need to place an emphasis on and see how we can help small retailers who are struggling with capacity, to give them the capacity to offer them the learnerships and skills programs, which we will pay for. But we will not only do that, we will also handhold them. We've appointed independent skills facilitators to assist us. So if we can, I think in the next 5 years, if we can make a big dent on participation of small retailers, I think we will be able to move the money. The reality is that we have close to 340 large organizations which have been participating for many years. And I think we've sort of saturated those organizations with learnerships and skills programs. And therefore, we need to look at a different segment to take in more learners. I've always said to my colleagues, if we can get the 11,000 small companies that are operating in the sector to just take one learner, train one learner on a learnership, we could pull through about 11,000 learners through learnerships, and that would make quite a big impact, and that will help us move the funds. But the reality is that it's an area that we recognize as an organization we need to rethink our strategies.
And then Makubela.
Maybe I would prefer if Honorable Khadebe didn't hear what I'm saying. But I'm taking this leadership. Is it national or we are concentrating on? Because unless if I miss it, somebody was like talking to me and stole my concentration somewhere along the way. But if I mean it nationally, like all the provinces, the nine provinces.
Yes, it is national.
Okay, that was the first one which is easily. But then I'm checking this issue of employed learners and the unemployed and the amount that you gave them, the percentage. The unemployed, you have budgeted 40 million, am I right? And the other, okay. And it's like there's more for the unemployed. But it's a follow-up question because you are talking of numbers. Do you have the data? You know exactly how many, or you just project a number and work on that particular number, or do you have numbers of unemployed learners? Because it's a very serious challenge in this country. People who are unemployed, we will be very happy to know that there is some company that knows exactly how many people are not employed. And if you don't have it, is there a plan in place and time frames as to when you are sure you'll be taking? Because we need those data for people who are unemployed. That was the second question. And then on women development, you see you have got the budget. We found an action plan. You say the stakeholders will come with an action plan. I thought a budget is informed by an action plan. Now you have budgeted without any action plan. And believing that the stakeholder, and the stakeholder, who would that be? We are not referring to us here, right? Is it higher education? Or are you talking about health? Because there is women and women development and children and ministry in this country. The last one was partly covered by Honorable Sukuzi. If you talk of income, interest, and surplus, do you do this as business, as so that it's fund generation? Because if you borrow money to students, I always think it's unfair if the banks lend money to them, because when they start working, they become poor. They have to pay back, and if you give them 13,000, they pay you times three. I know I've checked. It's like they pay something like 89. So that you help them, but at the end of the day, are you really helping or is it business? Otherwise, I appreciate that somebody is doing something about this, but we need to know. Thank you very much.
Fine. Chair, if I can respond, and the ratio of unemployed and employed, our experience in the past 10 years is that when we have a learnership for both employed and unemployed, we will always get a 60%, 40%, 60 employed, 40% unemployed. Because remember that primarily we have to focus on those that are employed, who needs to be upskilled. But often when we have a joint employed and unemployed, we get a 40% response rate. At times we have a separate program for unemployed. And part of the challenge that we have faced as a CETA is that when we roll out unemployed learnerships for unemployed, we put a condition that 90% of the successful learners must be employed by an organization, because we don't want to train for the sake of training. And often that is where the challenge comes, because organizations will say, you know, we want to assist with training and development, but we cannot be committing to a 19% employment rate. We have succeeded in some organizations, but in some they rather not even participate in the program. The second issue you asked is the MDP and the WDP. These are basically new projects, new programs in the wholesale and retail sector. And we believe that stakeholder participation is very critical here. The companies who will assist with the program itself have to give us input as to what are the types of programs that managers who are being trained need to undergo. What are the skills, what are the competencies that they have to... So we rely very much on working with the stakeholders. We will have a steering committee which includes the captains of the industry who will better inform the CETA on what are the key elements of these programs. Because for the past 10 years, the focus has been more on your NQF level 1 up to NQF level 5. But these are more at a higher level. And that's where we were saying the action plan is that we will gather the stakeholders around the table. We are prepared to fund it. The reason we've set aside the money is because we've already had two very successful international leadership development programs where we've sent close to 32 middle managers overseas, and therefore it is important that the stakeholders participate. The issue about interest, we are not in the business of making interest out of the funds that we have, because according to National Treasury regulations, we're supposed to disperse all the funds and maybe remain with 5 months worth of cash. But because of the write-backs on huge amounts of money to our discretionary grant, we also have a responsibility to ensure that the funds are banked with reputable institutions. So our plan in the next 24 months is to have a drastic reduction of the cash so that we don't generate a lot of interest, and we don't have surpluses as the report indicates.
Training, because this would company so that they do attend the training, whereas the employed are within the job situation where the training happens then. And then if I may just add, in terms of two types of interest, the other interest and penalties actually come from SARS itself in terms of learning certificate, and the other one is as explained by the CEO that it's interest earned from money invested.
I've noted three ends. Just a question insofar as you've responded earlier. You said something about small retailers, that is where you are going to. You didn't yet say in the last 12 months or 15 months. You can't really indicate to us what was the spend on the small retailers. And what you can do, just to have it now, if not, then you can just give it to us at the end. Yeah.
For the past financial year, we have spent about 55 million in terms of small retailers, and the bulk of that was the payback of mandatory grants, which could be about probably about 60% mandatory grants. And then, as the CEO indicated, the problem is definitely take up for mandatory grants, because I think we paid about 12 million just for mandatory grants.
For discretion. So in terms of the, if I hear properly, in terms of the small retailers, whatever that would be, if some of us are not yet clued up with all the technicalities, say for example, about your industry per se, but in that space, roughly 12% was on discretionary, and the rest, 12 million went to discretionary. The bulk was on mandatory, but your concern is that the strategy rolling out in terms of the small retailers, that's an area of weakness, if I hear you properly. Remember, we come from a perspective that says, how do we, in a sense, transform the industry and empower and enhance capacity right through. So I just wanted to just analyze that particular one. I've noted your end, CEO.
Jay, thank you. Maybe just and I think the CEO has already said, but we have just embarked on a project whereby we will take 3,500 youth, young persons, and place them in small organizations to assist them to actually get learning experience, because of the fact that we know the small companies are battling to participate simply because they haven't got the capacity and the know-how, the technology. So we decided to embark on a project like that. And 3,500 will be placed in small little companies, fully sponsored learners on qualifications from NQF 1 to NQF 4.
I'm going back to the end that I've seen. Member McVera.
Thanks, Chair. I take it by now we're asking questions beyond the original question that you asked when intervening.
Yes, I'm allowing that.
Okay. But I'm starting by sure that when we talked the dropout rate, I thought that was exclusive of the success rate. And I went ahead that coming sharply as to what exactly is the success rate. For those who did not necessarily drop out, who ended up completing the program, what is the success rate in that regard? But equally, you then talked RPI, and there was no elaboration. You only indicated the intention to implement RPI. It will then mean that within the organization, there's clarity as to how to implement it. Well, I did not get why it was not implemented all along, but now you're saying you want to implement it. Perhaps if you could share with us whether there's that clarity, because in the country, there seems to be a problem with regard to actual implementation of RPA. Your own understanding, I think just briefly, not necessarily going at length, if you were to implement it next month or almost immediately, were you going to be able to do that, and so on. Just share with us as to what informs the cost per learner aside 50 million rand for a particular program, what informs that? How do you arrive at the 500 or 50 million, whatever the figure is? You know, because part of why some money may not be spent, as you said, you're putting aside a lot of money and some of that doesn't get exhausted. What could be the fact? I don't think the fact that may be the response necessarily from organizations or individuals. The pre-learnerships programs, they are not necessarily determined by you. You cited an organization that has done that and they have just celebrated some success in that regard. I'm just worried or concerned about what may be the quality of those programs. Although you're indicating that they seem to be qualitative in that once learners have gone or undergone the FRALA program, they succeed more when they undertake your high-level programs later on. But who determines those particular pre-learnerships programs? And why are you not able to encourage all of them to undergo that program? Because if that will lead to them not succeeding at the end of the day, it's not useful to take them at a higher level when they will fail anyway to complete such programs. Last but one, the cooperatives, check. What is the picture within your industry? Do you have them? Can you share with us as to either the numbers of these co-ops so that we don't talk of something that perhaps does not exist or no one ever investigated or made that their own interest to ensure that if they are in existence, they are really assisted to succeed, or whether you ever met them in some forum or some kind of interaction which could tell what are their challenges, how would you assist them if you were to assist them, and so on, so that they are actually able to assist. The absorption rate after learners completed, you're saying you're not able to cause these companies to ultimately absorb them. They've got difficulties. But so far, what is the absorption rate? If we have got, say, 10,000 learners having completed the program, how many of them ultimately get absorbed? For those who have not been able to be absorbed, for me, they now have got the skill to can be assisted with some startup capital and so on to venture into their own. Are you able to do that as this particular sector? Can you assist in that regard, or they must go look for this capital or funding elsewhere, either in the banks on their own and so on and so on? So you're only concerned about them getting absorbed. If they can't be absorbed, then they're on the streets and all that. Lastly, Chair, very last one. What is the impact of these programs? After we have been able to assist them, say in a small business, have we ever analyzed the impact that comes with that? That by now they are able to succeed more because they got their skill. To saying the skill was the right intervention, they did not need necessarily something else and we provided skill. I'm saying, if a small business perhaps is struggling, not just because of the skill, but there are other things, and we intervened simply in terms of the skill, you know, I'm not saying the sector needed necessarily to provide, say, other infrastructure kind of things, say, computers, whatever, I'm saying our analysis in terms of the impact of the program, are we able to say, after having given these people skills, this is the kind of impact that came with that program. Thanks.
Mr. Defone. Chair, my apologies, the technology is failing us again. There are quite a number of questions. I'll try my best. The first one is the RPL. The member has noted that there is an intention to implement RPL.
Over the past 10 years, Chair, we will admit that as a CETA, we haven't made a major impact on RPL. What we did is a number of years ago, we developed an RPL toolkit which organizations could use, and we basically trained them on how the toolkit works and how it could benefit them as organizations. The reality is that we did not get very good results. I think there were just a few companies which implemented RPL on their own. And recently we had a conference in Johannesburg on how we can, as a sector, revisit RPL and implement RPL. And the outcome of the conference was that, firstly, the sector embraces RPL and would like to see RPL being implemented on a larger scale. Secondly, RPL requires a lot of funding because most organizations tell us that they can't fund RPL because it's a very expensive exercise. And as a CETA, we have agreed that we will need to, if we want to see the numbers and the impact, we must set aside money for RPL, because we believe it's very, very important that people have to be RPL even before they go onto programs. It will also be part of our recruitment and selection strategy. The second question is, when we set aside money for learnerships, especially for unemployed, what informs the amount? The amount is basically informed by two things. Firstly, is the management and delivery of the program, and secondly, it's a stipend. So, for instance, an unemployed learner, we need to allocate almost 35 to 40,000 per learner on a learnership, and I think if I'm right, 18,000 is for training. The difference is for a stipend. So that's basically what informs the amount. How many learners we would like to enroll at a cost of 40,000, that will give us the amount of money we have to set aside. There was a question on pre-learnerships. I said is that we noted that in organizations where there was a pre-learnership, there was quite a big success rate. And we believe that this is a model that we need to implement going forward, because the providers who run learnerships tell us that it's not a given that learners will be ready to start a learnership. So where they have been prepared for a period, we see better results. And so these are what we believe are best practice that we can roll out throughout the country. There was also a question on co-ops. We did research about 3-4 years ago when the new NSDS2 strategy was launched to determine how many co-ops there are in the wholesale and retail sector. And the research indicated that there weren't many co-ops, and this is co-ops in the strictest sense, the way that the Department of Trade and Industry describes or defines co-ops. However, we are aware that, for instance, there are all sorts of organizations in the country where people come together to buy products at a reduced rate. And we believe that as an organization, we also need to empower those small organizations to do just that. So the short answer is, Chair, that there aren't many co-ops that we know of in the wholesale and retail sector. We know that there are a lot of co-ops in the agricultural sector. And what we are also saying is that as CETAs, when we cooperate and work with the Agri-CETA, we will see how we can promote skill development amongst these co-ops. The issue about the absorption rate, I did indicate that when organizations sign up for learnerships, we have a condition as a CETA that they need to take 90% of the successful candidates. And this has been the case. But, of course, if you look at how many go through, if you say there's a 50% dropout rate, the success rate is 50%, we put a condition that 90% of the 50% of those that succeed must be absorbed by organizations. Of course, this is an issue that we've been asked by companies now to review, because they've indicated that they cannot commit to a 90% employment rate given the current economic environment. The impact of programs, Chair, after every project that we run or any project that we will be rolling out, there is an impact study that is conducted. For instance, 3-4 years ago, we conducted an impact study on phase 4 of our learnership, and we were able to understand what impact learnerships are having on organizations and how we can improve those programs. So on the one hand, the impact study helped us understand what are the issues and challenges in implementing learnerships. On the other hand, the impact study also informed us, for instance, why there was a dropout rate, why were the learners dropping out of the programs. I can't remember the question on small business.
I apologize for interrupting, but could you tell me how you measure impact? How do you measure impact? Following on Honorable Ocabella's question.
For instance, the impact on learnerships, firstly, will be whether the learners are competent at the end of the program. So how many of them were able to get the qualifications that they registered for? The second impact would be on the employment. For instance, the employed ones, they're already in the job, and therefore they remain on the job. The impact for them we measure is, having gone through the program, are they now advancing in the company? Are they being promoted? Are they doing different jobs that they have been doing? And I think the study was able to confirm that those people that have been upskilled in their organizations do make some progress in the organization. It may not be all of them, but we understand that the impact of the training is that they will benefit individually, but the organization as a whole, in fact, I would probably even say the sector as a whole benefits when people are trained, and we can see how many of the organizations are rolling out new stores, and they are rolling out new business operations. And that's how we believe skilling people is making an impact on the organization or on the sector. I wasn't sure about the last question. I wonder if the member can remind me of
it. Member McCullough.
I think coupled with what you responded to in the main, wanted the impact that would analyze these organizations as a whole, whether they're picking up, they're fairly successful. But I get it, the analysis that you did on the study did not go to that extent. So I think it will just be one other challenge that we must actually handle. But on it, we were saying, now that the intervention was with regard to scale, and that's your core mandate, the possibilities that in the small sector, that may not be the only major problem. There could be other things, but the intervention came the way of the scale. But we may find there are other key things that to get them to stand up and being successful or sustainable, you needed to handle these other things as well. Just even if it's not your core area of work, but to share with us to say what we find being the major challenges in this industry for small business are the following areas. Because our concern or our work is beyond just killing it, to see them successful and so on, and the economic growth. Now, we can only get this from some of you who come to be able to say, this is the other things that we may need to assist them. So that was the thing. But am I getting that success rate? If students or learners there were 100, 50% drop out, am I getting this understanding that the 50% that remains, there's a 100% pass rate or success rate. Is that what you say?
Out of the 50%, what is the pass rate of the 50%?
Okay. Out of the 50% of those that stay on the program, we could say about 90%. Plus minus 90% succeed, and it is that 90% that we have made a condition of employment with organizations.
Dr. Swartz. Jay, thank you. Maybe just to emphasize, and the dropout rate is a continuous challenge for us. We have currently got about a 54% success rate. In other words, 54% stay with the company. We have just embarked on a second pilot project with a little company, and we call it Grassroots, where we have managed to increase the success rate or the retention rate to 87%. And it's primarily based on what has already been said here. It's all about hand-holding and mentoring. We find that as soon as we start doing that with the youngsters, the retention rate tend to increase. So we are continuing with this pilot. We are running a pilot now for 200 of them to see at the end of the day what that particular percentage is going to be. At this stage, it looks very promising because the previous, as I said, pilot was 87%, from 54 to 87.
Can I allow Member Khadebe, Member Nelson, and then Member Gina, and then what we'll do after that, we'll then continue with the last part of the presentation, which is more on the profiling of the provinces, etc. So we'll do that. But I think, members, clearly what I would want you to do is also just to take note of some of the strategic issues that need to be taken up. For example, one, there is a consistent message that we get in, and this is possibly to the department, on RPL. It's just not good enough that we're consistently hearing the same song. Yes, we didn't give enough attention to RPL. What is that? Then the question around, is RPL a on top or is it part of, especially if you actually look at chapters of the board, this massive unemployment pool that you've got in our country. What happens end of this year? How many are we adding to that number of unemployed? So in a sense, are we in that type of level of paralysis where we just consistently saying, yes, this is the problem. Now I think if I'm wrong, and possibly the department representative here would be able to say to us, the NSDS draft 3 doesn't even speak on a rapid jack-up of RPL as of yesterday. It gives certain time frames, for example, later and not earlier. Is that still so? Because clearly this committee has a serious issue with that. Meaning even in its analysis into the future, based on NSDS 3, there's still a, yes, we will deal with it in 2014 or 2016. I forgot what was that actual time frame. What happens? So there's an issue there. Clearly, what I'm picking up here, there is a serious issue on the dropout and the analysis around that. For example, what is the status quo of those providers in your system currently where dropouts happen? What is the status? Also, if you in fact reflect on this issue about strategy, what I'm picking up, there is no real strategy when it comes to the, in a sense, the developmental part of the business. Developmental part, whether it's that co-op process or whether it is the small retailer process. If we are saying out, we are sending out a ad that says, and we are getting a turnaround of 12 million of that discretionary and not more, is to take up the problem from where the community participatory processes are, or from the way, for example, we assume. Is there certain assumptions that we are making when we put an ad out that, yes, indeed so, in these communities they will actually be able? What is the developmental process in that? And that's really, if you look at the holding hand issue, no rocket science in there. But we are not necessarily, for example, picking up a strategy with regard to that. It's incidental that a NGO or an organization or a Section 21 is in fact doing that. It is not driven. One didn't hear the broad profiling of this particular CETA in terms of its industry landscape in this country. Even in the slides, when you look at the provinces, I think it's important to give us just an idea later. What is, for example, the percentage of your levy paying in each province? What's your categories of prioritization? I'm raising that in a sense as an analysis of what I'm picking up. And if we are going to continue more on those questions, I don't necessarily think we're going to get the appropriate answers. That's my view here. And it's an issue that we obviously have to take up. Member Khadebe?
Thank you, Chair. Well, mine is relating to one of your slides here, that you have your collaborations with the higher education refugee. My question is that how do you identify which one of the refugees that you collaborate with? Because my view is that if your target is 2,000, you won't be able to reach all the refugees if you really want to make a very serious effect. Then also your intensity collaboration in terms of the rural development project. I think your target there is very much small, as is expected that, you know, at this current juncture, we should be able to have a high recognition of the rural development project and ensure that there's that upskilling in terms of that
target.
But also, I'm trying to get a sense here in terms of the marketing of this project, rural program. You said you are only using radio to communicate this project. I just want to get a sense because, you know, in some other rural areas, you've got other stakeholders that really make a very serious impact. Why do you use one means of communicating these messages? Why can't you at least have extra measures of using counselors or using the chiefs around those places? Because I think it's one of the other impacts that you can be able to communicate effectively this message to these communities. The summer course, so that is it. But also, you know, I'm trying to get a sense. When you say your web-based learning of 5,000 participation organization offered to one leadership opportunity, how do you identify them as well? Because in order to see an impact, you must be able to say, well, you get this feeder that gives you that opportunity. But how do you distribute them equally to the all provinces? Because my concern is that you will end up not reaching the destitute people. But, you know, say you've got an impact, but your impact cannot be able to be valued. Because you will take one individual there. How do you ensure that there's a real serious impact in terms of distribution of these things? I think Chaifa can be good answered in terms of those ones, because in some of the other questions you've already managed to come and be with my colleagues. Thank you.
Can I hear Member Gina Nelson, and then we just deal with those three hands, and then we get responses, and then we go over immediately. We've got the project to work on.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I'm worried by one thing here. When you're listening to the presentation, the time that they take to react to some of the things that they feel that they're not happening well, I think it's too long. I'll just take an example of the NGOs, partnership with the CBOs, NGOs. When in the presentation it should be said, for the past 10 years, nothing much has been done, but we are starting to work on that area. I go again to another area. When you looked at the reason why there's so much surpluses, one of the reasons was that the uptake is not good from the respective organization of stakeholders. And it is only now that they're beginning to say they're even exhausting some of the organizations that they are funding, and they're starting now to rethink what is going to be done. So most of the things, they take long to come up with the remedies or strategies as to what is it that you can do to better off the way that they are performing. So I'm a little bit worried, really, on that side, just to say, even in the presentation, it was said there are a number of programs where the uptake is not good, and they have observed that for quite a number of years, but nothing is in place as to what is going to be happening. I mean to say, if they can continue with the way, the pace that they are doing, is to say, they have to wait for the program and then try to rethink as to how are they going to manage that. We are not going to see the expected rate of implementation that you want to get. And lastly, Chair, can I just get in their projects and whatever, is there anything that they are catering for disabled people? Because we know that this is one of the vulnerable groups that we have. I'm happy that women and children are being catered for. Or is there anything that they have, or they solely rely on these NGOs and CBOs? And maybe with their linkages, as they say, there's nothing much that has been done by the NGOs and CBOs for the last 10 years. Their linkages with the municipalities as to how do they await for the programs that are going to that they can cater for in those NGOs and for the OIS. Thank you very much.
Jefferson Sainz. My interest is going to be around the strategies that they've got in place, the selection strategies. Jefferson, my interest is also going to be in the next, you know, in the next part of the presentation when we look at projects. When we look, we've got 9 projects in Gauteng. We've got 3 national, 3 KZN, 2 Eastern Cape. My worry is about provinces where Northern Cape, Northwest, Mpumalanga, Limpopo, Free State, where you've got very, very high rates of unemployment. You've got youth that is unemployed. You know, what type of projects are being run in these areas where your poverty levels are very, very high? Your 3,000 learners that you've spoken about that have been placed in small businesses would also be interested to find out whereabouts, in which provinces are they? Because, you know, from experience we see that things are happening in Gauteng, things are happening in the Western Cape, but we don't see what is happening in your smaller provinces. Your smaller provinces where you have extreme poverty, and what strategies are in place in those provinces. Thanks, Jefferson.
Subsection to that question, Mimi Mishwana.
Thanks for allowing me to just add to what was asked by Honorable Jean, the disability leadership. I see that you have it in Eastern Cape only, but want to believe that we have them in all the provinces. I only see that it's only one province. Because I know you'll go to this stage and say we're catering for them, but that is only Eastern Cape. But then the provinces, my concern is that to add to what Honorable Wendy said, why is Mpumalanga and Limpopo grouped together? These others, you know, they stand, it's like KZN, and the name of the project is there. You will see all these projects going to KZN and Eastern Cape. But Mpumalanga and Limpopo, they are put together, not even a name of a project. And that's where poverty is very rife. I just wanted to check why maybe the two, Mpumalanga and Limpopo. Thank you.
Can we get the responses and then we go immediately over to Chale? I also would want to hear the chairperson's view on some of the issues that we've raised earlier about the lack of strategic focus on the developmental perspective.
Sure, thanks. Maybe firstly let me just indicate that the profile of the wholesale and retail sector. There are close to 65,000 registered companies in the wholesale and retail sector. And 99.9% of those are small retailers. Secondly, the high concentration of retailers are in KZN, in the Western Cape, and in Johannesburg, in Gauteng province. And this is where you find most of the levy-paying organizations, most of the registered organizations. There are a lot of them in spread around the country, but the concentration is in those 3 provinces. And maybe that's why when the CETA started many years ago, there was first a concentration in Gauteng, and then we moved out to KZN and the Western Cape. And then later on, after about 4 or 5 years, we rolled out to other provinces. And part of the reason of putting them together at that stage was because there weren't many levy-paying organizations in those provinces. I do, however, take your point.
that there's a high level of unemployment and there's high rates of poverty in all the provinces. But initially we were working on that profile to make sure that we can get most of the organizations that are in those three main provinces to participate in skill development. In fact, when we started CETAS 10 years ago, there were only 500 companies that were participating, that were submitting their skills plans and doing the training. We now, after 10 years, are able to say the numbers grown to almost 5,500, close to 6,000. So it's been a gradual growth that we have seen. And the point the member made, I can't remember who it is, that we haven't in the past 10 years made inroads. I would respond by saying that every year we look at where we're coming from and we work on new strategies. With CBOs, for instance, in the past 10 years, I'm sorry, the impression I gave was that we haven't made any inroads in CBOs and NGOs and co-ops. We have supported close to 5,000 CBOs, NGOs, as well as informal businesses during the past 5 years. So we continue to grow the base. And one of the things that the board has now agreed is that we now need to establish a presence in every province. So you will now see that by end of March, we'll have people in the Northern Cape who will look at and attend to the Northern Cape issues. Because we believe that you cannot have a one-size-fits-all programs. You need to look at what are the peculiarities in each province, and make sure we get to understand what are the needs of each province. So at the time that we were growing our provincial and national footprint, we tended to group provinces together. But over the years, we've now also come to realize that even those groupings do not necessarily produce the best effect. So we will see new provinces rolling out, and we'll see a variety of projects and programs coming out of each province, because each province is, they're all different, and you can see by the favor of the projects. In terms of disabled people, we indicated earlier that we have a project that we are doing with the Thabo Mbeki Development Trust. There's also a very successful project called the EDEF, which is a project that we launched together with ShopRite Checkers. They trained about 38 people with hearing disabilities, and they've been employed in ShopRite Checkers. We now have a new intake. Chair, unfortunately, when it comes to this particular sector of our country, we've learned that we can't push the numbers. It's not a numbers game. You know that we're required to have 4% of our intake being allocated to disabled people. But the reality is that the numbers are not coming through. There are all manner of challenges that, you know, organizations tell us about. And what we have tended to do is to say, let's do small-scale projects which are very innovative, which can help us roll out to other provinces. So you will see in the next 12 months, for instance, with the Thabo Mbeki trust now that they've gained the experience of running projects. They've now said they will be rolling out nationally. Unfortunately, as a city alone, we cannot make an impact, but it's only when we collaborate with, for instance, the disabled people of South Africa that we can make an impact. The other issue has to do with FETs. We've been working with FETs for the past 10 years. But it has only been those FETs that have come forward or submitted their proposals to roll out our programs. And we've worked with them to capacitate them to accredit their programs. But now, in the new dispensation, we are looking at working with all FETs across the country. And what we have done as a CETA is we've made a contribution towards a research project that is looking at the capacity of FETs, what type of FETs we have, because we can only work with all FETs when we have information. So we will be getting this research report in August, which we believe will help us roll out more programs to FETs. We also need to understand which FETs are specializing on which sectors so that we can fashion projects in that area. The issue of advertisement of programs in rural areas, we note that this is not the only medium that we can reach people in the rural areas, but we've always done adverts on newspapers with major newspapers which don't reach those communities, and we've come to the conclusion that we need to use your community radio stations. For instance, there is an organization in Johannesburg which can link any organization to about 60 community stations simultaneously to advertise and discuss skill development issues. We haven't
CCI is there.
And so we also looking at working with the structures like community, the councils or the municipalities in those areas. So we're just mentioning radio because it's an area that we haven't done, but we are cognizant of the fact that there are a variety of mediums that we can work on. The reason that we have only 2,000 for rural allocation is not an indication that we don't want to roll out too many, but we believe that before we can have a national rollout of a project, we must have a pilot project and make sure that it's successful. We can iron out all the challenges, and then later on we'll roll out to more projects. I'm not sure, Chief, I've answered all these.
Can I request you now to continue? I think we are noting some of the issues. I think some of the responses we're not satisfied with in terms of just some of the strategic real interventions. For example, if 99% common 9 is on small retailers, I would want to know what is the spend in terms of the actual provision of these opportunities in work integrated stuff to the small and to the large ones. Remember just that as a CFO, that is something that you, in a sense, needs to give us as well. Because then we'll see, is there in fact, harmony between that, or is there disorder in that space? But let's continue now for the next, in a sense, because some of those slides, you don't necessarily need to go through every single item. And I'm going to give you 10 minutes.
So you also asked us to do a SWOT analysis, and without going through each line item, just to indicate that we see one of the major strengths of our CETA being sound governance, and as well as having large constituencies that are contributing levy income, which is something that we can use. In terms of weaknesses, I think some of the weaknesses we've discussed in the course of the discussions with members of Parliament, but in our view, the disbursement of funds remains a very, very big area that we need to work on. In fact, I just presented to the board about 3 weeks ago a cash disbursement strategy that will take into account how we can disburse the funds and make sure that we roll out more projects. In terms of opportunities, we think rural outreach and participation, which we think will work if we collaborate with other sectors. The reduction of unemployment amongst young people, and that's why we've set aside almost 250 million for this particular area. These are just the opportunities continued. We do recognize that we need to sharpen our strategies on SMME so that we can get all the 11,000, at least the 11,000 levy-paying retailers. But the number is quite huge. In terms of threats, Chair, perhaps the first one there is the whole area of relicensing, but we know that the NSA and the Minister are working on. And that the issue of loss of credibility with stakeholders, as an important stakeholder, we recognize that it's also in your interest that we are successful, and we believe that we need to make sure that that credibility is not undermined. In terms of provincial allocations, so we've just noted special projects which we were doing in the different provinces. These are the current ones that were running. They do look small scale, but I think I need to indicate that some of the provinces are fairly new. They've just come on stream about three years ago. So we will see more activities as these provinces roll out their projects. I think your observation that there are more projects in Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal is correct, but that is partly because most of our retailers who implement programs are coming from those three provinces. KwaZulu-Natal, we do have current projects, but these are the proposed ones that we are going to be rolling out. Eastern Cape. And then, Chair, in terms of reduction of, reducing the high levels of employment, we have set aside almost 300 million. You can see on the slide, 50 million will go towards the final year students who are either finishing or graduating. And then the 253 million has been set aside for matric school leavers, unemployed graduates, and retrenched people in the sector. We also have a project here in the Western Cape for FET colleges, 10 million was set aside. We have a huge project for learnerships and skills programs, 100 million. So all in all, Chair, there's almost 400 million worth of projects that have been set aside to make an impact on the unemployed people. Chair, in terms of accredited providers, we have that spread that you see. The majority of our providers are in KZN, in the Western Cape, as well as in Gauteng, with a few in other provinces. There are about close to 69 BE providers who've been accredited. And in terms of budget allocations, these are the providers who are currently participating in our program. So the allocation here is what projects have been approved. I think out of 69, we don't have more than 20 that are participating. But we do have a plan to make... Come again. You mean their profile? Yes.
Is there any last point that you want to make before we get
I think as far as the different topics are concerned, we're done.
Members, I'm going to allow the next 5 minutes. Clearly, it's not necessarily only for questions, it's also observations that you can advance. I do believe that in this particular case, we need to request the CETA to come back at an appropriate time, so that we can zoom in. I must say I'm not comfortable as I'm sitting here. And it's more on the strategic kind of processes in a developmental perspective. So it can be that we accept this presentation and we say thanks and we see you in 3 or 4 months, but we don't want to do that where I'm sitting. So taking that into account, let's have the next few minutes of engagement on this matter. Member Khadebe, Member James, Kuza, Mushwana.
Thank you, Chair. I want to request the CETA to go back and rework their current special projects. This is really disgusting. You can't come to us and tell us that there's a program that is being shaped by the President in the State of the Nation address of addressing issues of rural development. And you come here, you give us a project that is, most of it is dominated by the urban areas. You are really telling us as Parliament that what is said by the President was stupid. Well, President, what he's saying, you don't even recognize it. He's establishing a project in Muyeshe, in Limpopo. Instead of recognizing issues, he's saying Eastern Cape and Limpopo, those are the one province that are most vulnerable, that need a very serious attention in terms of alleviating poverty and unemployment. But you still continue ignoring the call of the President. And we expect us as Parliament to accept this kind of document. Myself, no, I, Chair, the CETA, I really please, I plead with you, you go and work it out very profoundly and, you know, recognize what the President has requested us to work on. Because it will be really undermining the authority of the President. Yes, Chair.
Member James.
If I could just raise some questions that I'd like you to take back with you and come back to us with answers, and there are 3 questions. And they're all empirical questions. Firstly, what percentage of your budget do you spend on management and administration as opposed to the money that ends up in projects with learners and students? So just the percentage on that. Secondly, I'd like to know how many new entrepreneurs have entered our economy, small entrepreneurs in your sector, in the retail and wholesale sector, have entered the economy in the 2009-2010 financial year, and how many entered the economy as a result of your funding? A very specific question. And the third question is, what are your plans, detailed plans, and what funding are you setting aside sort of organized mentorship program, the same issue that the chair raised about the development perspective. Mentorship is key to containing dropout rates and to give learners a sense of comfort in being leaders in their field. And therefore, it cannot be an afterthought, and so it has to be planned and it has to be financed. So I'd like to know what it looks like and how much you're going to spend on it. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Just very briefly, CEO, it's just about the whole presentation, which is fine. I would have liked to see what the scenario was before you came up with the strategy. In other words, if then you are budgeting going forward, is that 10% of whatever line item that you have, what were the gains that you made in the past year, so that you are able to get a context as well. Because then you do not know on which, what is the basis for you going forward. So we see the projections, we see the targets, but then what were those previously, to the extent that then you are able to measure the progress or lack thereof. So that's number one. Number two is just a comment that part of your threads that you put up there, the fact that you have, one, the low uptake, and two, the high dropout rate are equally threats. They are also threats to your program because they stand in the way of you achieving your goals. So it also is a threat, and probably you want to flag them so that by the time you go forward, you have them as one of the things on which your strategy is based as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I think I'm partly covered by what the Honorable Honorable Khadebe said. And want to emphasize, I've noted with concern that you decided not to respond to why you are pairing Mpumalanga and Limpopo. Side that I would like to add to your weaknesses as your right to say that you have there is inadequate communication reach. We can assist you by giving you contacts. Actually, we need to take your contacts to the FETs within Limpopo. That's a promise we can keep. And Mpumalanga, because yes, we have been paired together. I wanted to know why you did that. You did not respond to that one. And humbly, I would say, as that is a weakness, that you don't go to the rural areas where poverty is, where you are supposed to assist. You are very busy with work outing. Western Cape, you know, if I look at the amount given to Western Cape, it's so huge. And they don't really need it the way it's needed at the other places. So please, there is no contact number here. If we can get that, we'll definitely make the FETs call you. Because you are saying that they are not giving you their project proposal. So we'll go and ask them. We need your contact. No way do I find them. Thank you.
Also, thank you for raising Member Lachetsu's question. Ms. Nelson and Magibela.
Thanks, Jefferson. Maybe I'm going to ask, I'm going to come back to those other provinces that don't refer anywhere in with projects. I'm going to ask Jefferson in the previous years if there were any initiatives in those provinces, so that we can see if there were any initiatives. And further to that, if there has been any contact made and no responses, that maybe we get that information that we can go out and try and do something in those communities. And the last one, Chairperson, would be around there's another one that I wanted, but I'll come back to that. Thanks, Chairperson.
The very last, the leadership response of the CETA, thank you, Bella. Silence, your hand was up.
Chair, just on three or four things. One, without elaborating. I think if there could be a clear proactive or initiative plan by the CETA as to how, with clear target dates and so on, how do you want to implement RPL? When are you going to start with that and so on and so on? And probably for now is not even budgeted for. So it's more an intention, really. So even if the other organizations may not be ready, are you able to place incentives and so on and ensure that that happens? And perhaps you can come back to us in that particular regard. The cost to me, even if you were to work within the same budget that we have got, it's just an issue of balancing out. Let's start somewhere, you know, and be able to move forward. Anyway, you'll take part of that money, place it on the programs that are easier and less costly and so on and so on. When we could do something, even if it means 10% of that on RPL or something. But let's take a move with that. The second will be a clear analysis on these cooperatives and actually what could be done. So that we don't talk at surface level that there are co-ops and we may want to interact with them, we may want to assist and so on. So, but we are in positions of authority and responsibility. We can get things done, you know, and that's the difference. We can't talk like we are not sure what will happen and so on and so on. Because our task is to ensure that that which we must do is done. And then let's get a move in that regard. The last relates to your clear plan about reduction of the dropout rate. I think you will need that analysis with a view to saying this can be the interventions that you think should be done. Yes, we won't be able to refuse if people want to move into other immediate job opportunities that could be there, probably. There are those that will be objective problems, but there are those that we can be able to handle. And if you could be able to say, this is the scenario, this is what we think we are capable of handling, this nobody else can assist well, and so on. But at the same time, include the success rate, which any one of us was going to look for 100%, but it may not be very possible. I was looking at the program for disabled persons, the Tabombeki and so on, trust and so on, which also pointed the 50% dropout rate of some kind of failure. And I don't think it's because they moved to some other places and so on and so on. On those, we can be able to do something as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I would want to give the CEO the opportunity and then the chairperson, and then I want to close this section.
Thanks, Chair. I think some of the issues raised, we will gladly put together a response on especially the strategic issues. But just to quickly point out that in terms of our administration, we are allowed to spend 10% on administration. I think in the past year we've spent 9%. We spend about 9% on administration. Some of the issues that you've asked us will show in the annual report, which we will table at the end of this month. And then in terms of the new venture, how many enterprises? About 117. That's also in our annual report. 117 new enterprises started businesses that we funded. We note that you are concerned about the initiatives in other provinces, and we can only promise that the next time we come around, we will be able to respond more forcefully and more positively. But just for members of the portfolio committee to know that we do have plans in place to ensure that we do reach the rural areas as well. And then lastly, Chair, the issue of RPL. We just need to indicate here that we do have, after the conference we held in April, we've now put together a project proposal which is going to our board in October for the rollout of RPL. So project will be implemented to roll out RPM. We do acknowledge that we left it to the sector to implement over the years, but we as a CETA need to take leadership in RPL and implement it, and that's why there was a conference in April to understand why RPL is not being implemented in the sector. And one of the major issues, it is cost. I mean, you have to assess people when you RPL them, and it comes at a cost, and we believe that as a CETA we have set aside money for them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, as a board, and I want to come to the question of why Mpumalanga and Limpopo are clubbed together. The rollout of having to develop provinces, offices in provinces, it is an ongoing issue. And of course, as a board, we have discussed it, and management has also placed before the board the action plan in terms of how. Now, recently in this year, most of the provinces were clubbed together, Free State, Northern Cape, they were together. But however, we have now started divorcing the provinces to stand on their own, and therefore in the process of having to staff there. So before we open an office, we need to actually have a clear picture of the province where to actually begin to place the office. On the issue of the rural development, it is an issue that the board actually takes it serious. And at every meeting of the board, it is a matter that the board is actually beginning to deal with the issue. The issue on the collaboration with the AgriCETA, it is a matter that the board has actually said management needs to come with a strategy to actually begin to say, as we look at the sector, you know, it's not concentrated within the rural areas, but however, you know, if you take the issue of the agriculture and retail, you know, because of some of them, they directly retail, etc. So we need to have collaboration as the two CETAs to actually begin to roll out and make it a point that though we don't have much of a presence within the rural area, but we also deal with the development within those particular areas. And be rest assured, Chair, as we have noted, the other issues is that the issue that has also taken our time was the issue of, you know, migrating from the Department of Labor to the Department of Higher Education, the uncertainty in terms of what's going to happen, the new NSDS 3, you know, having to be licensed for a year. So therefore, you know, we then had to try to concentrate more on having to begin to look at the issue of NSDS 3, you know, and of course the relicensing of the CETA, and of course the uncertainty, you know, in terms of rumors about some CETAs are not going to exist, what people are saying in the media. But be rest assured, as the South, when we come back, we're going to come back fully prepared.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I think you've been prepared insofar as those issues that you are doing. So I want to acknowledge that. I'm glad that the Chairperson has spoken of the board at the end. The issue is that, in a sense, while the Roma burning in terms of unemployment, are we maximizing what we've got? That's really the issue. And if we are we maximizing in a way where you spend then 20 million rand into a ShopRite engagement, and what is the issues in relation to that, or are you spending it in a developmental perspective? If you unpack that program, what is the supply chain? Is it Van der Westhuizen? Van der Westhuizen, what would that be in the context of the supplies? In what way does ShopRite then conforms to the broad-based empowerment when it comes to the supplies of that initiative? I hope you understand where the issue, for example, then would be in the context of a developmental perspective. That's the issue here. That,
So we zoom in a more deeper sense than to say disbursement has happened. We know you can move disbursement. In fact, I've seen one of the threats, the SARS collection system, and I was thinking that SARS, it's normally happening proper in this space, so it was interesting to pick up that point in the thread, but most probably it's a preemptive concern as well. I've also picked up the National Treasury, the concern, but we've equally got concerns if we see all the money. In fact, NSF has given a 900 million rand allocation to provinces. 400 plus million was unspent over the last 3 years. They registered as surplus. That's the point. We are picking the same issue up in the CETA environment. The Mr. Wynn, the page 14 on the NSDS3, back to RPL, the recognition of prior learning, the success indicator for NSDS3 says all principal sectors and national programs to include RPL, to include RPL access routes by 2016. What does that mean?
Thanks, Honourable Chair. I just want to mention, when we are talking about NSDS3, I think we all know that this is a draft document.
We know it's a draft.
Yeah.
It's a draft.
And the department has basically embarked on a process, the so-called public consultation process. And they're now busy concluding that process, whereafter they're going to assist all the inputs. And I think, Chair, you also did refer to the concern that was raised by this portfolio committee. So they're going to assist all those concerns, whereafter the National Skills Authority will then advise the minister. And on the advice of the National Skills Authority, the minister will then publish a second draft for comments again. But the concern of this committee is noted, and it will be communicated to the NSA when they're going to advise the minister. And that will happen soon. But like I said, they're busy concluding now all the comments they've received.
Yeah. Can we say, Mr. Wynn, the person that's consistent in raising that sit on the far left there, and the point here is, even in the way therefore it's being written, there is a approach. It's an approach of it's not an urgency. Meaning even in the draft per se, that's the issue. There is a, in a sense, just a general calmness when it comes to the RPL issue. Now, unless the country then say RPL is not important, we can have this type of documentation. We say something, but in terms of its actual documentation, we pick up other issues. And most probably something that you out of this meeting again formally needs to take it up. With the relevant structures. We're not going to have a situation there where we're even going to assume the NSA and the documentation coming from there if the RPL issue is not properly being dealt with. Not in its semantical space, but in a very real process. You also pick up in the NSDS draft 3, it's thin on RPL. So it's an area of, if we are saying that is a strategic imperative of the state, then clearly it has to come through in that way, in terms of our national skills agenda. And it's not coming through in that process. I hope that those issues are minuted in that one. Then, in the conclusion on this part, we will then request you to return. We will give you the relevant time frames of that. But in addition to issues that people raise, these are following things as well. The organigram of the management and of the institution, we didn't get that today. But if we can just make sure that we've got that. Also, it's affirmative status in that space. Then the three provinces, Western Cape, Gauteng, and is it KZN, where biggest spend are, also the organigram in that process. The analysis on the high dropout rate, and people have spoken to that. And then obviously the retention strategy in that regard. I think we've spoken about the smaller retailers, including the co-op agenda, and what is the strategy? Not how do we disperse the money necessary or look at it ad hoc, but what is the actual strategy with? I've seen one of your opportunities here. There is the opportunity says a vibrant informal sector. Does that therefore speak to a strategy of which we didn't hear? For example, we've heard about a under take up in your is it discretionary? But and we've heard about 99% on small retailers not necessarily spend, but that's your industry makeup. But we didn't hear, for example, the informal sector and what is the strategy on the informal sector, if that is a vibrant opportunity, as you put it up here. So that is an area where, in a sense, you want to zoom in a very strong, profound way to give us analysis when you come back. What is that makeup of the informal sector in this industry? What is the training currently happening there? Not necessarily your training, but general. What is the interventions of the state in that space, and what is the training that you are doing? Kind of an analysis on that space. Then, most probably, this doesn't need to wait for that comeback meeting, but you've indicated 65,000 registered companies, 90%, 99% small retailers. Can you also do the break of spending from where you're sitting in terms of the percentage spent on the small retailers and the percentage spent on the larger retailers? Can we also have that? So that we can just see, is there 90%+ spent there on small retailers based on that categorization? I think the rural development question has been raised, and I've picked up in the discussion at least 3 or 4 provinces. I think it was Mpumalanga, Limpopo, Northwest and Northern Cape. I think Ms. Nelson raised Northwest and Northern Cape earlier. So that and therefore the development of a particular intervention for those provinces, understanding you're not able to roll out immediately possibly offices in each province, but that intervention, and that means, Member Khadebe, most probably it requires the CETA and the Agri-CETA to in fact go into those 4 provinces in a collectivity, even, for example, with the legislature members that side and the MPs and so on and so on. And we'll most probably be able to get a report on the suggestion there. Also, the apart from the organigram in terms of the equity status, but also the disabled sector, in not now in the beneficiary of the projects, but also now in the structure of the administration, in terms of are we meeting our percentage? Is it 4% that you've mentioned? Are we meeting it? Are we not meeting it? What is the situation currently in the administration? Not necessarily at head office only, generally. I think there was a request for just to analyze the 3,500 learners to be spread at small companies, and because it's a new program, but it's more what is the spread? At a provincial level, what would be that spread of that 3-5? Is it all in one province, or would it be different provinces? And are we taking consideration of the points that has been raised? We've seen the allocation on 100% BEE spend. What is the actual allocation on the non-BEE spend? We didn't touch that. So if that, in a sense, come forward as well to us, and then the RPL is not, it's to yourself, but in fact, more importantly, I think, to the department, because it's, meaning it's not only the CETA's problem. It is something that we are picking up across the spheres, and in particular in higher education institutions as well. So it's not only the CETA in this case. So it's a bigger issue here. It's a question predominantly around, was there under-representation from a department insofar it speaks to RPL, both at the Department of Education as well as the Department of Labor in the past. Members, we will now excuse the management and the leadership of this particular CETA. We will just have a refreshing few minutes of at least maximum 3 minutes whilst the CEO and the leadership of AgriCETA is just
putting this stuff in place. Thank you. And we will identify whether it will be over the next 2 or 3 weeks that we will ask you to come back.
Thanks a lot.
Agri-Sita, we are three.
It is me, Jerry Madiba, the CEO, and with me it's Jack van Dijk. He's the vice chairperson of the CETA from Employers Organization AgriSA. And at the back of us is Johan Engelbrecht. He is the manager operations attached to the CETA. Chairperson Sipho Khumalo from FAO could have been here, but we are busy with our work because we are preparing for our AGM, and he is assisting the team that went out. Our apologies that he's not here.
On the boer is this hard work. Yes. I'm feeling it more. Don't worry. I'm just messing with you. I thought you're not gonna pick it up. Let's continue here.
Well, Chair, I should also say the female that could have been with us. I should just put the record straight to answer your question. It's she is also busy with awards. Actually, she's a manager, corporate, and when people are going out with awards, people out there are terrified of the team that comes. And when there is a woman who would put things into perspective, we thought she's needed much out there than here. Perhaps I should indicate that we have brought this book, which is much more clear than the presentation that we have given. We have made it lean and mean, so that it should be understandable. And this is included in this document. It's this document. You'll have it as the first in the book. It's covering almost every question that were sent to us to can answer, Chair. We will see it here, and perhaps when I'm presenting, we will refer to it. Also attached here, it's the budget allocation that you'd see at the end. You will also find breakdowns of the profiles of the staff. You'd also then find the service level agreement, which then forms part of our strategic document, that the service level agreement would have informed what we planned. So it's for your take home, but we will refer to it because it will bring out many things. The presentation is on itself, it's very short. I should also observe to say, because we had this, the CETA before us, the expectations would be, and I rightly think the Honourable Member who spoke of and asked about percentages, because I think when we speak of allocations of money, percentages are very important to can reveal other things. There might be a CETA with so many millions, but you find that they are using the same percentage with a smaller CETA. And normally what we then observe, we'd observe the percentage, we'd observe the number, the quantity, other than the percentage that has been given. Now, I should say from the beginning that as the AgriSETA you'd see in here, that we annually, 2009-2010, we had a total amount of 162. You'd see it in here. And out of that 162, honorable members would note that the 20% does not even come to us, then goes to the National Skills Fund. What then comes to us is the 80%. Now, out of that 80%, 10% will be for administration, and we normally, how we operate in the CETA, we don't go over the 10%. Now, after we have said that, of that 80%, actually, a bigger amount, 50%, actually of the 100%, goes into mandatory grants. Now, these mandatory grants will be the money that will be claimed by the employers out there, the levy payers out there that are paying this money. And roughly it comes to about 74 million. It is 20%, it's 50% of the 100%. And only 20% is for discretionary amount. So if we speak of the whole amount and the amount that we have got to disperse as that receipt, we then speak of about 45 million. Now, we are working to raise our mandatory grant to a higher percentage. Our claim from the mandatory grant has been 70%. It has gone to 71%. Last year, I think 74% has been claimed back. Now, if the 26% remains, we take out that money, put it as part of the discretionary amount, and we find that whatever we will distribute will be about in the region of about 70 million, but would have benefited from people that have not claimed the mandatory ground. And I thought I should lay the ground, because if the other CETA would spend about 100 million, we will never have that 100 million in a discretionary amount. Let me start by defining the mandate of the CETA. We know that the mandate of the CETA chair is laid out by Skills Development Act, Section 10. However, we have the following, and the board has allowed us to cover the following as part of the mandate of the board. And I just mentioned them. Some of them are well known, but the first one is to serve the total agricultural sector as demarcated. And I'm saying like this because the levy-paying companies are quite few, but we serve the whole levy-paying company. And this we include, Chair, the land reform recipients. We also include the rural development as a whole. And I think, as it has been mentioned, if AgriCETA will not mention this, it might be killed, because rural development and land reform is actually part of us. So we serve the total agricultural sector as demarcated. We address needs of commercial and under-resourced in a balanced manner, meaning that even those that will not contribute levy, the board has allowed us, even though we serve the mandatory grant of the levy-paying companies, to cover them in a way. The other one, we consider interventions holistically to make maximum impact. We will explain this as we go on. Massive skills upgrading to address general low skills level. And if we speak of low skills level, we speak of those entrances there. We speak of the ABET that people would want. We speak of those NQF level one that people entering into agriculture would want. Above that, we also then go to NQF level 4, where there will be people trained as supervisors and people that will run farms, meaning that they don't have to get only a technical skill, but they are able to say, how do I budget, how do I use this money, what is required out there. And we eradicate specific scarce skills and bottlenecks, and we are driven by the sector needs rather than the scorecard. It's very important that we mention this, because there has been an expectation in the past of Department of Labor that they give you this scorecard, you have got to perform, and then they say you're performing. But if you are in agriculture, you perform that. The question that would arose with people out there would say, what about land reform? What about this? So we it's very important that we, even though we are seeing the scorecard, we then touch other mandates that are very important in looking at agriculture. So those are in short, the mandates of the AgriCETA, other than those prescribed by the Skills Development Act. Let me shortly come to the strategic plan, and we will then go to the section here in the book. But when we deal with our strategic plan, you'd note that the NSDS will be 5 years. We have to make our sector skills plan at the core of the AgriCETA strategy plan, but then we come with a five-year plan. After we come out with a five-year plan, we have got an annual update. We look at the scarce skills, and then annually, we have got a service level agreement. Now, in the book, I will then refer you to the service level agreement that we have. And then out of that, then we have got targets set, and we have got discretionary funds allocated. Now, those are the 20% plus whatever has not been used by the mandatory grant that we target that, because the mandatory grant, the levy-paying companies will claim back. Now, maybe we need to shortly go into this, because it will cover the whole thing. If you see on the first page of the book, well, it will be the mandate. And on the second page, we'll then be dealing with the budget shortly, but I'll refer to the other, and then we deal with other things. But if you go on after the blue divider, you will then get our Schedule 1 of the service level agreement, and this then will cover most of the things that we speak about when we speak of our strategic plan. It's not everything. It's a summary of those that would be very useful and which will then inform how we move about. Now, after we jump another blue divider, I must say the person that has been helping with dividing this was specifically made. That's why there's no color coordination. It's just divide. It's just divider. So my apologies for that. After that, you would then see an audited financial statement, just something that we will deal with it very shortly, because we do also want to refer to page 22 of that, and we'll also want to refer to the first two pages to clarify certain things. So the whole booklet will actually inform us how we move forward other than the presentation that I am making. Now, let me come to the fourth slide. The fourth slide speaks of then the total discretionary fund that which we have, but I'll refer to the book again. It says, our total discretionary fund is 74.8 million. Out of that, for the employed, we have funded 2,240 learners to the tune of 23.4 million. And for the under-resourced, the unemployed, we have funded 1,350 learners to the tune of 35.3 million. Having said that, let me refer you to the book to really make, to add flesh to the bone that you see there. You will see on, after the first page there, that we will say we'll have a summary of targets and budget allocation in the book. We have not drawn them there. They are in the book, where then we have shown that How do we support and where do we support? We have said 1.1, we have allocated that for development of sector skills plans. We then 1.2, we said we communicate externally, and this we do in a form of roadshows. You will see when we deal with our SWOT analysis that we only have got one office. And to fight that problem of having one office, we annually by February go over provinces as running road shows. So we spend that money. Mandatory grants is 70 million. And we have said that is for the large firms, the other amount for the medium, and the smaller one is 980 small firms. But we then also then support BEE firms, 70 enterprises. We will explain this when you ask, to the tune of about 3.8 million. ABET, we have allocated last year 4.4 million. We used to allocate much more money, and we're using a computerized system, but we have then cut down on that because we have realized that with the amount of ABET needs that is out there, we will really, and we have agreed with the department that whatever they put as a target, it's just impossible in the agri-sector because you go out there, people work right through the day, in the evening they are so tired that many that want ABET only want to reach level 2 of ABET. They are not interested in level 3 or interested in level 4. They only want to read and write and read their Bible and be able to count and open a bank account. That is 1 and 2, but they just don't want to go further. So we have cut on that. What we were doing to support that, we were using a computerized system. We were using MediaWorks, where we have put a lot of computers at different farms, where people go out there with the interest in using the mouse of a computer, they get into programs, and we have seen a vast improvement. However, that does not reach the real rural areas, and with that, we have allocated this amount for face-to-face. The employed, which is skills programs, we have allocated 70 million. Support to NGOs, CBOs, CBCs, including cooperatives, 3.3 million. The unemployed skills programs, 29 million. Now, why this amount of skills program? Now, skills program, if I may explain very shortly, we refer to short courses that are unit standard based, meaning that when people do these short courses in agriculture, we just don't want them to do them and finish, because the temptation out there of farmers is I need a person to make a fence, give us a short course in fence making. When you look at that, it's not registered, and when that person finishes, he cannot articulate to higher, so to a higher qualification. We are saying whatever we are doing, these are short courses, but they are based on unit standards. And we have allocated more for unemployed because these are people, some of the people get land from rent as a land reform recipient. They need to use, they will need a short course to be able to plant vegetables, how to prepare the soil, how to water, and so on and so on. We have got those in broilers. They will need a short course, how do I raise chickens or broilers? And you see, that's why the amount is too much out there. And I should also say that you look at other sectors that are big. When they allocate this, they'll say 100 million, 50 million, but we don't have that amount. And that's why the issue of percentage is very important. We have also allocated for workplace experience 2,310,000. What we do here is you find that people have gone to universities of technologies. They have done a two-year program, and they need a year for experiential learning to be able to complete a diploma in either animal production or plant production or mixed farming. We then, with the agreement of commodity organizations, we work with 11 of them, There are about 30 of them, but those that work very closely with us are about 11. We then co-fund. In government, when they give a workplace experience, they pay a learner for 4,000. We only pay 2,500 per month, and the rest, commodity organization fit on, and then those people get experience. We also then include those that would have finished degrees, and then they would need that 1 year. Then we have got NVC, venture creation, to the tune of 1.8. ISOEs, these are centers of excellence. We only have got 5. We still have to grow them, but we stopped mid-year because, Chair, if I may, we wanted to include agricultural colleges because we are having about 11 agricultural colleges, and we have said we have been having commodity organization as ISOEs. We need to bring institutions. So we have got 5. For now, we will then be increasing them. And then we also have got other skills program and so on, and those are the amount that is there. Now, if I may then go to the audited financial statement, because I need to show you where this amount comes from. That is the last attachment that is out there. This will then show you, it's part of the audited financial statement that you will see when you'll be seeing our annual report, which has to be tabled. The first page just shows the breakdown, the amount collected of the levies being 161 for 2009 and 2010, but for 2008, 2009, we collected 142. And just in short, we are proud to announce there that our levy has grown by 13%. While if you go to other cities, their levies getting dropped, ours is growing. It's not because of salaries, but you find that other people leave other cities and come to us. And I just want to show you towards the end, admin expenditure is 19 million, and a surplus of about 9,735,000. If I can explain, because I know that the surplus causes a problem. What we do in AgriCita is that we advertise once what people out there need to apply for. After we have advertised, then people apply and we allocate. After we have allocated, if you come to the Western Cape after you have allocated, people will not give you a contract back. They will say they are free from, Jack would help me here, from a certain time around April up until August before they can go into harvesting. That is the only time that they have for training. Now, during that time, they will not give you a contract back. And according to a regulation that the Harness would explain, is that they will then regard any money as that has been contracted, meaning that you have got a signed contract, as the only amount that is not a surplus. If you don't have a contract in place, then you have got a surplus. So we then had an accumulation of this, but then we have a way of dealing with it when the financial year ends. So it's actually not a lot. Now, after I've shown you that page, you'll be free to ask questions, but I need us to go on to page 23 or 22. There on that is on page 22 there, you'll see a spreadsheet of some sort. Now, you can ask questions after you have looked at it, but I just want to show you on 4.1 there, we have got something known as mentoring and support for land reform beneficiaries, which is about 20 million, that Last year our board approved that because of the rural development and land reform being very important as a priority of government, out of the limited resources that they had, they then allocated 20 million to support land reform recipients in terms of mentoring. So the 20 million has been there, and it has been topped up very recently from the National Skills Fund to the tune of 44 million. So we will then be reporting in the next financial year of the 44 million, but then we have got 66 million that we are using for land reform recipients. We are working with the Department of Minister Nkwinti on that, but the programs that we are working on, we are concentrating for now in three provinces, that is KZN, Mpumalanga, and Limpopo. And as more funds will be available from the National Skill Fund, we will then allocate that. While we are concentrating on that, we have been advised from the new department that most of the people that have got a need are concentrated on those areas, and we are using those as pilot. Perhaps we can pause up here before we go into the other things, but I can continue with the other things. Okay, now we shortly have got a SWOT analysis. It is much more in here, but here we have just made it short that on our strength, we have got a big stability that you don't find. We have got the stability of the stakeholders, the board, and the staff. We don't have a high turnover of the staff. We have about 44 staff members, you'll see it in here, but most of them really stay at the CETA. But on top of that, what we have, and it's because of Jack and Sipo, that we have got a stability of the board. We have got a board that is, some of the members have been there in the old Payeta, Sitasa, and then the AgriSita. They have been there with a lot of experience. In the board, what is happening is that there is this year Jack is a vice chairperson from employers, next year is a chairperson. Sipo from employees, FAU, will then be a vice chairperson. But we have got a great stability of the board. They never vote because they always reach consensus. They said they will never vote because that will divide them. So we have got that stability. We also have got we are meeting targets according to the Department of Higher Education and Training. We are not proud of that because whatever targets that are set, there is much more needs out there than the targets that are out there. Of the weaknesses that we have got unsettled staff, and I'll tell you why. We are having a merger that is proposed merger, but we have been chained a bit this year because you can't move, you can't appoint other staff. You've got a contract extended up until March. So staff then remain unsettled because we have been proposed to measure with Foodbank. I don't know whether this is a weakness, but we have classified it there. We have outsourced our financial services. Deloitte is doing that. But we have an advantage that we have never got a qualified audit report. They just do a good work. But well, you pay for that service because we can't get a financial person inside and pay that person for the person to stay. Another weakness is that we have got only one central office, only in Pretoria, and therefore our staff travel very extensively to reach all the provinces. Opportunities, involvement in land reform. This is a new issue, 20 million, gratefully from the board, 44 million from the NSF, so we have got that opportunity. The other one that we have an opportunity is an opportunity of mentorship. We in agriculture, we have realized, and the chairperson would have to look at this, that people doing learnerships, especially the unemployed, they would hop from one teacher to another, depending on the stipend. We were paying about 600 stipends for the learnership, which is very small. We have increased it to 937 per month. Roughly in a learnership, we only pay 7,000, and we used to pay 4,500. If people here of wholesale and retail that pays in the region of 30,000, they won't stay at our theater. They want to go there. So the problem with learnership is that people that are unemployed would hop from one learnership to another because of a stipend. And our board has been looking at the issue of mentorship to say, can we take as a CETA mentorship very seriously? If we are giving people mentorship, we don't only give them a learnership. We say, holistically, what do they want? Do they want skills program? Do they need ABET? Do they need venture creation? And they take those things holistically and then support. And we have supported last year alone about 127 farmers in land reform. Many of them were in the Northwest with Makhali's Grain Corporation, where they were planting sorghum, sunflower, and Johan, what is the other one that we're planting? The maize. We got into partnership with these people, and then they will give them whatever they need. They'll supply them with finance. They will supply them with a person, and we found there that an Afrikaner that speaks fluent Tswana, you won't pick it up when you listen to him on a radio. He's out there with them. Whenever they need, he is out there. But we then went out in January last year and compared the fields of those people under mentorship with the fields of a commercial farmer. You wouldn't pick up a difference. In terms of sunflower, the expected yield is about one ton per hectare. They produce to an extent of 1.3 tons per hectare because of mentoring. It has been very successful. The other one that took a lot of time is Bethlehem Trust around Free State. We supported apple farmers. It would be a good project for the portfolio committee to consider visiting. It took us 8 years because we are saying in mentorship it should be less than 5 years, depending on what you're doing. But it took us 8 years. But for now, those 34 apple farmers are exporting overseas. They even have their own cultivar, what we call that cultivar, Pink Lady, which is very popular. But it took us a long time. And we are saying we have an opportunity. We have increased that to 160-something to more than 200 to concentrate on that because we have seen it as something that is working. Our board support us fully, and they are helping us with that. And the other opportunity that we have an opportunity of working with provinces. Why we do that is that at the premier's offices, especially in the Eastern Cape, they get money from the National Skills Fund and work with us in agriculture, in assessment and so on, and we are working well with them. Northwest is following suit. Limpopo is a little bit slow. I won't get a question over there, but we are trying, but we have that opportunity. Western Cape, we work quite well because a lot of levies that are being generated actually comes from the Western Cape. Threats that we have, there might be many, but we just took the cream. Negative impact of measures on agriculture. Our board went extensively out after an announcement that AgriCETA will measure with food and beverage. Well, I'm mentioning it. I know it is not for the house yet. But their concern was that if you mix the primary agriculture that is rurally based with food and beverage that is urban based and serving corporates, the Coca-Colas, the South African breweries, the big wineries, the Tiger brands, what do you then do with rural development and land reform recipients? because those people will not have an opportunity. So then they issued up a research report. Professor Kess, a professor from Stellenbosch University, did that report for us. Professor Beng contacted all commodity organizations, organized labor, organized employers, and out of that report, only one was supporting the merger. All other people said commodity organizations will disappear. So it's that thing that is holding us back right now to say, how do we go forward? The other one, Hannes is here, we will hear about it, and I hope it's not going to go back to the department and we get disadvantaged. Last year, we are grateful they gave us $44 million. But in the past, whenever we applied money from the National Skills Fund, it's very slow response. It's ad hoc response. We applied for 84, we got 44. And that money is really targeted. So you don't know whether you're coming or you're going. And I think they have got having their bureaucratic structures that hold them, and that's why it is very slow. But we could use that money. And we had a pledge from wholesale and retail. We will take that money and use it. But that is a threat on whatever we want to do. And the other one is excessive reporting bureaucracy. We are not complaining, but you'd be wanted a lot of papers other than going out there and work. But we understand it's a system, how people have to be accountable. Then... Well, those are the finances, but I think I've dealt with them, that the levy income grew by 13%, mandatory grant payment grew by 20% to 73 million. We are reaching a target of 74% claiming back mandatory grant, because in the past people say the forms are cumbersome to do. Admin expenditure only grew by 5% within 12.5 limits. Let me explain that. I'm saying 12.5% limit because I'm using the 80% that we are getting. But if we go back to the 100% of the levy, it's below 10%. So it grew by 5%. Provincial Department of Agriculture are coming to the party to say, we are giving you the administration amount. So we had that growth. Reserve dropped by 7%. And project expenditure increased by 96 to 93 million. We had a lot of surplus last year, I think around 34 million, that the board instructed us to deal away with. And then we issued up a lot of applications for skills programs, for cooperatives, and so on. Let me finalize by going back into what you have in the pack. And I want to go in after the SWOT analysis, which we have dealt with, to go to provincial allocations and special projects. That will be page 3. This is, honorable members, a breakdown of what we are using, what has been used in provinces in 2009, 2010. We have not put up the amount, but we can do it very easily. When that is wanted. In terms of learnership, in the Eastern Cape Skills Program, ABET, Bazaar, intense workplace experience, apprenticeship, total of 1,210. Routing, 1,746. Free State, very little. KZN 472, but I should say we are working quite well with the whole Tongaat and the whole sugar industry, because they are also in our board. But you'll also find that you think it's very small. In the Eastern Cape, they flow into the Eastern Cape in terms of farming. So you might find that we are avoiding cross-subsidization. Limpopo alone, honorable member, it's 2,883 that we are supporting. And it's the board might kill us on this because we are not even getting much more levy, meaning that we are paying Limpopo more than they are doing. But we have a commodity organization with a fruit out there, and then we have got the ZZ2 that also contributes quite a lot. So it has worked there. But I think also with the two universities and the two colleges, Masivandela, Tompi Seleka, as colleges of agriculture out there, working with University of Limpopo and University of Venda with the Premier's office. I think that's why the figure is high. 735 Mpumalanga, Northwest, 728. Much of the Northwest, we work with the Transvaal Land Board in it and very serious about training, as well as in Limpopo. When it's coming to food security and training, you might not agree with them with certain ideologies, but they're very interested in training. And with the fruit industry, they're doing quite well in harnessing training. Northern Cape, very small. The reason being Northern Cape is sparse, but we are having farmers that are really working there. But I know in comparison, it's very small. The department is paying well the levy with no problem. Western Cape, 2,712, we are working with a lot of farmers out there and commodity organizations that are not actually taking all the money from training from us, but they are also putting on and running very good programs. One of the programs that is being run by the Cape Women's Forum, I should mention that one, and the Dudoy Group, when you go out, they are running a program that we have been supporting. They call it Fole Mane and Fole Fro. What they do in those programs is that they take out people that are waiting there on farms that have got problems of abuse of alcohol, not studying, and run them over the program. And after they would have done that, they promote them because these people have changed attitude and so on and so on. And we are working quite well with a lot of farmers in the Western Cape. And the total there is about 11,161. It might be very small as compared to what the other sectors, but keep in mind that is because of the mandatory amount as well as the discretionary amount that we have. Profiles on the following pages, board members. I should say we have got board members of of 20 amounts, African 10, colored, meaning 50% colored, no, Indian 1 from the from Tongat Hewlett, white 9, which forms 45%, disabled 00 for now, and I think it's those people that are waiting, and that's what we have found. So we have got a total of 20, female 3, male 17. Maybe it's because it's of agriculture, but we'll change that in the near future. Profile of staff members. African, we have 27, which is 61%. Colored, we have got 6. 14%. Indian, we have got 2%. White, we have got 10, 23%. Disabled, we have got 1, and she has given us 2%. The total is 44, female 29, male is 15. And we are having more females in the CETA than the males. Profile of management, chief executive officer, it's black and male, it's me. Manager operations, Juan, is white and male.
Mr. Madiba, I just want this, already one of our members had to leave. There's another member and it's from different parties. And I just felt, just if we can just give us 2 minutes, literally just something to be of information, not on your topic, that I wanted the legal advisor, just to whilst some of our members are still here. would you mind if you just give us 3 minutes quickly, Mr. Madiba? No, 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 it's fine. But just put the mic. Just put the mic on. Members, this is a matter that we've dealt with last week, and why I have to interject is Member James is also supposed to leave. We've already indicated early, as well as another member. No, but you can't, Chief. You just arrived now, so we'll write to the speaker in this instance. The we can't assign the attendance registers. They can't work. What we'll do is we just want Advocate Gordon. Just remember, members, the issue was the 3 bills in front of us last week. The bottom line was, if it is minimalistic in nature in terms of its presentation, semantical changes, minister to higher, labor to higher education and training, do we require a technical participatory process, or do we in fact can just agree in the committee and pass it on to the NA, and as Member Bonamo indicated in the last meeting, even just have a few minutes of debate around it, or not even a debate. That's the issue at hand. What you've agreed last week is that we'll go back to our political parties, just make an assessment in our study groups, and then come with our views. I will ask people just to hang on, just to hear what is the legal representative of Parliament saying on the matter, and then I'll allow 2 or 3 comments.
I think the matter concerning the 3 bills before this committee is rather pertinent. The question, as the chairperson has just stated, was one of to what extent do we need to be paying attention to public participation on bills that seem to be relatively technical and consequential. The first point that I shared with the chairperson is when I did the opinion on these bills for the JTM, I too was of the opinion that these bills are really just trying to clean up what the proclamation of 2009 had imparted, the changes that moving the function from the Minister of Labour to the Minister of Higher Education and Training. So much so that when one looks at these bills, it is an or, a z, a comma, a must, was and Minister of Labour now being read Minister of Higher Education and Training. So it does seem very consequential in nature. And taking that into account, the question is, do we have to go the full slog when it comes to participation? Or do we, in actual fact, have to pay attention to public participation at all? And the long and the short of that is to be found in Section 59(1) sub A of the Constitution. That section basically says the National Assembly must, big word, written in small letters, but it has big implications, must facilitate public involvement in legislative processes and other committee processes. Now, I need members to concentrate on that. Before we get anywhere else in that section, that word must. What is that word must? It's an obligation. I must do something. When you tell your children go and do something, you must do it. I'm not giving you a discretion. I'm telling you to go and do it. And that's exactly what the Constitution is saying to the National Assembly. You must. MUST, facilitate public involvement. When we look at Section 59, 1 sub A, amplified Section 2 of the Constitution, Section 2 of the Constitution says, the Constitution is supreme law. Law or conduct inconsistent with it is invalid. Obligations imposed by it must be fulfilled. And I think that is the long and the short of our answer. If we don't comply with Section 59 sub 1A, it means we are then in breach of Section 2 of the Constitution. It renders our conduct in this committee invalid, and it exposes this bill to constitutional challenges at the Constitutional Court. Having said that, the next question is, well, these bills are consequential, technical. To what extent do we then have to do public participation? And I think the first focus point is that Section 59 1A speaks of facilitate public involvement. And we had a case at Parliament, or at least where the Speaker of the National Assembly and the Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces was challenged before the Constitutional Court in 2005 in the previous Parliament on this particular question. Sorry. Certain bills were rather technical, some were put out for public participation, and some people felt that it's not good enough Parliament to be taking you to court. So the question came before the Constitutional Court, what is meant by this facilitation of public participation? But the court looked at it in the ambit of the obligations on the NCOP and the provincial legislature, which is a mirror image of Section 59(1)(a) applying to the National Assembly. So drawing from that case, what is important is that facilitate is seen to make something easier, way forward, access, bringing in. Now, even though these bills are consequential, technical, nobody's really going to have an interest in it, that's not a call for this committee to make. This committee has the discretion once it has fulfilled its obligation to facilitate public involvement. Then we have to go to Section 57 of the Constitution, which says that we can prescribe our internal rules, procedures, and proceedings. We make rules of houses, and so forth. What that basically means is we have to look at the standard applied in Parliament. How do we then facilitate public involvement according to the standard set by Parliament? And that's usually our public participation practice. That is where we advertise the bill, we invite submissions, we have hearings, and we then invite the public to be part of this process. Now, one could argue that if we put out a bill for public comment and we receive nothing, that's where our process ends, and that's correctly what the court said. If something is technical and we put it out to for public comment but we receive no response, it would be illogical for the committee then to hold public hearings because nobody's interested in the bill. But we would then be able to show anybody who challenges the National Assembly that we have indeed complied with Section 59(1), but indeed there is no public interest. So we haven't overstepped our constitutional obligation. We haven't put the proverbial cart before the horse. And that's really in a nutshell. The committee does not have a discretion to decide whether or not to comply with Section 1. It's the extent of that compliance where the discretion lies.
Thanks, Madam Advocate. I think it's quite clear. Let's get the response before the member leaves.
Well, I welcome that. I mean, it's clearly a legal opinion, looking at constitutional provisions. So thank you very much for doing that. There's one bill that, in fact, substantively is problematic, potentially, and it requires a resolution, and that's the Higher Education Amendment Bill, which tries to set regulations for the registration of foreign service providers in the country. And there's nothing wrong with that in terms of cleaning it up, but it might have the unintended consequence of not being entirely enforceable, or at least enforceable in a way that would compromise student choice. So that requires substantively a discussion. And I've already had representations from very key stakeholders in the field saying that that's a problem. So that's my view. I would support this. I think we ought to have a public hearing of at least a day to look at this. So, thank you.
Thank you.
May I be excused now? Thank you.
Yeah, just on that one.
Just reply to the member through you. I think what is pertinent is that we had an oversight or study to a visit to various parliaments, the legal office, some years back to look at their systems and how they were dealing with public participation. And what we found was a very notable model that was used in Australia and New Zealand, where, for instance, what the honourable member says now that we should have maybe a day of hearings on the bill. You can only make that judgment call once you've received your public comment. You cannot make that determination before the time. It may be that you receive 500 representations from the public and then your one day would be out the window. So that call the committee needs to make by applying its mind once the adverts have been placed and then the response is then analysed.
Member, we can excuse you. Any other member on this particular point?
No.
Member Bernal?
What's that? No, Chairperson, all I wanted to say that that's why at my age I've decided to register for a law degree. That's why, all what I can say at my age, that's the reason why at my age I've registered for a law degree.
But you can see how, remember, you can see how polite we at times are from the front. We knew you were wrong last week, but we were still giving you the benefit of the doubt.
Wrong, it was just a different opinion.
Yeah, okay, no problem. Yeah. Anyone else on this? Can we agree that we then process it?
And then we are hearing that whatever comes in the public, the moment that we put it out, we cannot assume that we, because even if you put out the bill, even if people are going to start raising issues in that, we're going to then have to deal with it. So that's the issue. Yeah. Advocates, thank you so very much. We know that you were in the morning, and I've suggested that you come at the end. So thanks again. It's really clarified. It was a hard debate last week. Thanks so much. Let's then move back to, I think we came to the end of the presentation in terms of that slide. And then the CEO was busy giving us a bit of a synopsis in terms of the analysis of the profiling. Thanks a lot, Advocate. What we then will do, is there any last comment or two that you want to make? Taking into account that obviously members only received this morning. So we are not able, even if you are taking through us, you've now referred to some of these sections, but we would want to actually study this document as well. Because, as you're saying, this is a few slides, but these are the substantial notes. And it's best for us to then also analyze that in that particular way. But any last comments or two from your side?
Well, thank you. It's just on the last page after that slide where we have put a slide of accredited providers. But the last one is on the youth. Just to say, we have a big challenge in agriculture that the people that are at farms or interested in agriculture, you speak of 50 plus, and we are still trying to get people interested in agriculture, so we are supporting not interested in agriculture. So those that enter into agriculture are those that would have failed all over, and then they come back to agriculture. So I think that was the last point.
Mm.
Perhaps the vice chair had some comments, especially on the threat of the season.
Deputy Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable members. From my side also, it's a privilege to be here. Perhaps just the one point that I wanted to stress. We're not talking about primary agriculture when we talk AgriSeta. AgriSeta is the result 5-6 years ago of a merger between primary agriculture CETA, the old Bayeta, and the then secondary agriculture CETA, CETASA. If you look at the total contributions from the secondary industry, secondary agriculture industry, it's approximately 60% of the CETA's total levy income. Whereas the farms, primary agriculture, only contribute about 40%. Just to give you perspective, this is out of approximately 40,000 commercial farmers. And our total number of farmers contributing at the moment, 3,000? Yes. So the bulk of the income is from the larger secondary agriculture industries, like sugar industry, maize industry, and people like that, the red meat industry. Just to give you that perspective, because AgriSeta is not just the farming. The farming side, although they employ the biggest number of people, they are actually a small component in terms of the. Just to give you that perspective, Chair. Thank you.
Is the of noted hands, Ms. Shona?
Thank you. I'm not going to talk about the POMPO, I promise you. I just wanted to say I was once in an other committee, because you are talking of agri. This is farm. And we came across a farm. I was frantically going through my notebook to get the name of the farm in vain, but I tried to see once we get our report. Because we went to Northern Cape, to Free State, and Cape that in 3 days. It's like you went to these places. Am I protected?
Beginner, I know Limpopo is not always important for KZN, but for this committee, it's substantial.
Yes. Thank you very much for protecting me. We found a farm which was bought in one municipality, whether it was Great Kai. I don't want to give names because I can't find it here where it's written, but there's going to be a report. The farm was bought for 9 million. with you. And it was fine. The signatures that I got for the municipality to pay for that particular fund was 200 families. But when we went there, we found only 50. Actually, they told us there are 50. The people that we got there were plus minus. They were less than 10, 6, 7 people. They told us there are only 50 people who they don't have anything to do. The farm has been greater. The farm that was selling a lot of maybe wines overseas is now not doing anything since it was bought. It's a waste of money. So that if we can find that information and maybe give it to you, because I see you go to all provinces. I wonder if you have come across a farm which, since it was bought, it's not producing anything. Otherwise, I see you are concerned about all the provinces there. Yes, you are doing what?
Yes.
I think you are doing your best. But we need you to go and make sure that the funds that were bought so that I think it was Black Empowerment. But ever since they were bought, they are not moving. What can be the challenge? Thank you.
Member Digogo.
Impressed by the level of disbursement. The fact that they are able to disburse 80% is something uncommon as we interact with other cities. The other challenge that I'm talking about, hopping from one city to another by learners, I don't know the extent to which that could come together, because the reality is that many of the learners, for them, it's not a learnership, it's employment. They go to AgriCita, they are paid 700 rand. After 5 weeks, regardless of how far they have gone with their learning, they hear that another Cita is paid 2.5. They go there. Just like any other person who go to a better paying job. Whether there is some kind of database where we can ensure that this thing doesn't happen. But it's a waste of money. But like I say, for many young people, it's not an opportunity to learn, it's an opportunity to earn income. And because of that motivation, they'll go to whoever pays them the highest. The other comment that I want to make is the issue of habits. They are saying that people don't want to go to level 3, level 4. Maybe again, the question is level 3, level 4 of what? Because what we have seen with others, maybe the B is the problem, the basic part in others. I don't think my mother would like to go to be taught how a frog reproduces. If she can read, if she can write, the next thing she's going to need is a skill. How far have we gone to try and introduce and move away from this quote-unquote semi-academic kind of adult programs for adults, because many of them are taught things that they're not going to use at all.
The last person, Michael Vena.
Yeah,
thanks. I think the committee will do well ignoring what was being said. Just three things. The first, what is the cost for the industry being plus minus 40,000 farms or companies and the response rate being 3,000? Perhaps if we could assist them in that. Second, it is within this industry wherein we needed to hear more about cooperatives, and there's no talk about that. And I know there are people, perhaps they may not be paying levies or whatever, but what is your interaction with non-levy paying kind of farmers? The last one, Chair. I know some individuals who have got these aspirations or ambitions for farming, they are actually farming. They have experiences. They might have run farms, big farms, commercial farms at some point. But as and when they retire, they still are willing to run farms, and they are doing this now on their own, out of the commercial one. And they may not be paying levies, they may not even be known to them, they may not be registered anywhere. What happens with those kind of people? How do they get to be known and be assisted on, or try to be part of some programs that you may be offering? Thanks. Negative responses.
Thank you, Chair. Two questions will be replied by Johan at the back. The one on asset and the one on all retired farmers. But just in short, AgriCETA is according to Skills Development Act for training. Sometimes we get where people say, how do you assist this? In the last portfolio committee when it was labor, people said, what farms have collapsed, how are you helping? We only get in terms of training, and it's a very difficult job where to draw the line. If people have brought attention to other people that need help, we go to the board and say, here is the money, how do you allow us to divert the funds? And that has been done in the past, but we have limited funds for that. The other question is on terms of 40,000 versus 3,800. The Skills Development Levies Act was, the threshold for paying levy was raised to 500,000. What that means is that people paying minimum wage of 1,200 should have more than 42 permanent staff members paid that 1,200, multiplied by 12 months, it has to be more than 500,000 in the payroll. Many of the enterprises in agriculture don't have that many people as farming. So because of that, they fall below the outside the levy pay, and then they don't pay levy. But they will still need support. So they will not be generating 500,000 as a threshold for permanent. So that's why we have a problem with that. The issue of jumping from one ownership and another, we have it. But because AgriCETA operates more on rural areas and rural-based enterprises, we don't have a dropout rate that is high. It does not even reach 10%. Joanne, I think I'm right on that. People that enter there are so hungry that they look at an opportunity. Or land reform recipients that have got land and they are using that land to really farm for themselves after some time. So the stipend that they get, at least they are able to buy seeds or do whatever. So we just don't have that high dropout rate as the others. So we don't even feel that they would have decided to come back to farming and then they stay there. Do you want some other questions?
Chairperson, members, good afternoon. With regards to AVET, I fully agree with what you said, sir. The whole issue of AVET and the consistent drive to necessarily progress to an AVET level 4, including subjects that's not relevant in the environment within which that person work and live. Most of our AVET learners exit at level 2. Numeracy and communication, or let me rather correct that. Most of our learners exit when they've done communication at level 1 or 2, not even numeracy, but a major problem in having people to continue into the numeracy side. So we have already started, we're busy with looking at what we call at this stage agriculture vocational access program, trying create that bridge between basic communication, I can now read my Bible or I can read my whatever, into the world of work to try and pull people through. Unfortunately, most of our AVET learners are very, very old, high HP. non-levy payers, I think that is what you used the example, sir, of a retired person. But I think the reference by the member is actually to non-levy payers. We in AgriCETA have got a policy, and Jerry made mention to it, that we will support the non-levy payer equal to the levy payer. If he is a bona fide person in agriculture, the access to funding in the CETA is similar to the access to funding of levy payers, so they can also participate and benefit from funding programs, learnerships or skills programs from the agri-CETA. A last comment, one which was made on cooperatives. In the bundle that's given to you, you will see that we've annually got targets in terms of supporting cooperatives. Last year, we've supported, depends on how you count it, but somewhere between 150 and 200 cooperatives. Sometimes it's an individual person, but most of the times it's cooperatives, mainly through mentorship programs. What is also very interesting, and which I would hope this portfolio committee could one day look at, is we have just completed, in conjunction with the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, a very, very novel program, which we call Farm Together, where people, literate or illiterate, in a cooperative, through a learning program that stretches over quite some time, will learn to plan, manage their own cooperatives. A very interesting program. We are now busy training the first 42 of our accredited providers to be able to deliver on this program. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you. Can I suggest the following members? That I think the biggest problem, the way I read the situation here, is that if you've, in the words of Member Khadebe, prioritized rural development as a strategic thrust of a post-2009 policy perspective, to what degree does that align in its implication on the budgetary process? So what you essentially playing around with, what, 70 million rand? When the thrust of your rural development strategy, therefore, would be in the rural provinces, which speaks to agriculture, farm dwelling development, farm worker development, co-op development, etc., etc. in that. So, 40 million rand would be in another CETA 1 program being rolled out in MERCETA, for example. So that's the problem. Hence, if we so agree, we in a sense therefore need to indicate that we're not happy with the allocation of funding to this particular CETA. How far can you go? So if you are really want to develop co-ops, say in Limpopo, based on an agriculture intervention and a farm dwelling intervention or co-op process, can you do it with 2 million rand, as an example? Or are you in a sense throwing money to something, because that 2 million rand possibly will just deal with a very little elements in a real co-op strategic process? I wonder, CEO, is that not a big problem from where you are sitting? I know every CETA will say more money, but just on the back of what's being given the responsibility with a focus on rural development. Rural development zooms in generally, but in particular also on agriculture environment. We've seen the national ministry, which you've referred to now, with stakeholders had last week or 2 weeks ago, a farm dweller summit. What is the implication of the outcomes of that summit in the context of your responsibility? And can your funding match that, or are we putting the right words there, but literally we don't have the money to do what we're supposed to be doing? So, yes, most of the CETAs have that problem, but I think in particular
taking into account what our members consistently raise around the focus on rural development, the question, and we know rural development is beyond your confines of agri-city intervention, but it's not exclusive to agri-city intervention. And that's an area I think that we need as a committee to give consideration to. We've picked up in the presentation on that NSF and the bureaucratic processes. Does it affirm or does it curtail your interventions in the, in a sense, in your mandate? So NSF must come and explain this issue in the context of rural development and agri-cities responsibility. If you have to augment the financial and other capacity required for this intervention, then everyone needs to come to the party. So one doesn't necessarily therefore want to deal with some of the, what we want to do is we want to go through the document. We already indicated we want to call back the CETA that was here before you. This CETA, we don't necessarily want to call back on your own. The NSF must be here when we engage you again. But then what is the other strategic CETAs, the primary ones? There's all the other CETAs can play a role, but I'm picking up wholesale and retail. You've got some form of partnership going. What is the other strategic CETA that needs to be in your space? Deputy Chair?
Chair, I'm not so sure that I'm qualified to speak on that. I think it should rather be going to Jerry, but could I just pass another comment on your line of thinking? If we look at the fact that the CETAs operate in terms of a levy system, I think we can agree that the levy system is not suited for rural development. Full stop.
The levy system is not suited for a real rural development intervention.
I think if I may add to that, what you would need in terms of that specific strategy is to single out one CETA that could specialize in this. And obviously the agri-CETA would be one that would be best positioned for that. So, but I cannot... Chair, if you don't mind, if I could ask our CEO to just respond.
Members, let me just explain the problem of what was just said. And Member Ginner didn't believe the Vice Chair possibly, because he was shaking your head. It would be interesting to hear comments at some stage. But the problem is, if you take the Western Cape, it is apparently supposed to be one of the better in terms of agricultural activities, right, in terms of money. But there was research done and currently national research says that complete majority of your farmers has less than 5 million rand turnover a year, right? So the point is, if now that's in the better, one of the better of provinces, what therefore in Limpopo, what therefore in rural provinces? So if you then need to align a rural development intervention, the money, if it is only based on the levy, that's the point really. That if you expect the money to come just from the levy to serve that sector, not that agri-CETA only serves the rural development arena, but it is primarily in that space. And therefore, if it's a low base of levy income, your point around 3,000 vis-a-vis 40,000, and if you then unpack in terms of income, an annual income or turnover, then you see the problem. And if that is so, those assumptions based on national government analysis, if that is so, the implication around the expectation from the agri-CETA side, there would be a wobble there. Hence, it's collaboration, and how do we, in a sense, bring others together? What, Mr. Madiba, would be the other CETA that you require to play in your space?
Chair, if I may, I think local and government CETA, because the people that approach us mostly are from municipalities.
Okay.
And when you want to help them, you know, whatever levy is there is in a municipality. why don't that money then benefit them? And that is another one that we want partnership. And if I may, we once did a research in AgriFit, I think in 2003, where we then find out that with the levy system not working, perhaps out of treasury, there might be a funding allocated for rural development and land reform, specifically for upgrading and mentoring, and that might work. And last year as well, chambers that came to talk to us as the AgriFit said, we need, especially from the National African Farmers Union, say, we are not paying the levy, we will not even reach there. But they needed a separate funding model or budget to concentrate on their farmers distributed all over to capacitate them in terms of training. So they might need a separate FITA or a special focus funding.
The very last person, and then I'm going to conclude.
No, thanks, Jefferson. My apologies, because I'm aware that you were wrapping up. But that's the comment. Look, we can agree that the levy system is not the best. But how long is it going to take to change that? Assuming that we're going to go that route. But I thought the Jefferson one right here, you say the NSF must come in. Because our understanding is that while the 20% of the total money collected goes to the CETAs, 80% goes to, but the issue is that, for example, they are saying they got 44 million, if I'm correct. Could they come up with a program, a funding proposal to say, this is what we want to do in terms of rural development, this is how we want to assist people in the farms, cost it and give it to the NSF. Maybe if NSF does there, but the question could be, where else could the money be found? But I agree that this function has to be fulfilled.
Thanks. I think the member has picked up what's the suggestion. In the interim, how do you, in a sense, bring together? And I think this committee have that responsibility to ensure some of that can happen. Can I then say that we are meeting local governments CETA next week, so remember that we raised this issue as well. Collaboration between this CETA and that particular CETA. At an appropriate time, we will bring the cluster in terms of the CETAs in the rural development space, primarily when we focus on agricultural development and obviously secondary and broader rural development. We'll be able to bring the cluster together and the NSF in terms of what is the actual project that will make the appropriate impact based on our mass scale problem. We've agreed, Member Makubela, we at some stage agreed to have a skills in DABA. Most probably the skills in DABA for the first one that we will be having, and we've said we must program it in this term, in September. Most probably it should actually be around rural development and skills and the skills intervention, so that we zoom in based on the urgency that I've picked up earlier. Members have raised, in particular Member Khadebe and others, around the rural development questions for Parliament. So let's take it from there. But thanks so much for your presentation and the discussion around it, because it was really the discussion that was more important than your lean and mean four slides that you had. Members, we will just pass minutes after this, and then we'll end the meetings and we will excuse you. Thanks, Vice
Chair. Thanks. You should not forget that there's study group, number one, number two, who are going for.